5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, I wanted to talk about behavioural economics. Unfortunately, I don't know anything about behavioural economics, so it was going to be a very short one. However, I found somebody who does. Josh, thank you for coming on.
You're more than welcome. It's so nice to be back, yeah.
You have some passing understanding of the subject, do you?
Passing, something like that.
Right.
Yeah, I did do a master's degree dissertation in behavioural economics,
right.
Yes.
Okay.
And I would say it's probably my specialist field within psychology. So
superb.
I feel like that's just about passing, maybe.
Yeah, I think that would do us nicely. So perfect. So I mean, behavioural economics is one of those things where I think I must have internalised some of the lessons from it, because in doing the research for this, I started realising, oh yeah, that and that and that crops up from all over the place, but never looked at it as a sort of coherent thing. So, I mean, the first thing I've got to say is where does it actually come from, this? I mean, what's the history of this subject?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, you've got a psychological perspective on economics throughout all of human history, as long as people have thought about economics.
Mm.
Obviously, economics is dealing with the actions of human beings, and so people have thought about the impact of human psychology on economics for some time, but it's not necessarily been formalised. And
right.
the process of formalising it as an academic discipline was quite a long one, really, in that sort of in the early 20th century, economists, as you may well know, they sort of scorned the notion of approaching economics as if there was a psychological dimension to it. They liked to go through a sort of pure mathematics route, and although that made it quite empirical and objective in a sense, it also had a model of human behaviour within it that wasn't really exposed to a lot of the insights that we got throughout the 20th and 21st century in terms of human psychology. They had a model, the sort of classic economic model of human action, that suggests that human beings are perfectly rational economic actors, and we always operate in our self-interest, in our best interests. And actually, things started to emerge in the latter half of the 20th century which counteracted that. And it's worth mentioning as well that the psychology of the early 20th century was sort of psychoanalysis, so your Sigmund Freud, Carl Jung's,
yes,
and your behaviourists, who are, you know, like Skinner, it's also, or Pavlov, where they're looking at associative learning. So you can see why they didn't see much relevance to economics at the time. But by the time the sort of 60s comes along, and you have the cognitive revolution, which is a sort of reconceptualization of how to approach the human brain, in that it's treated like an information processor. And you actually start, it's amusing, as you start seeing more and more computation, you actually see more and more computational language to describe the human brain. Like the term processing power or RAM is just as easy to use as an analogy for the human brain as it is for, you know, an accurate term to describe different components of a computer. And in many ways, the terms we use seem to have a surprising amount of cross-pollination.
Yeah, that makes sense. So hang on, so are you saying that behavioural economics, did it emerge from the field of economics or from the field of psychology?
Well, it was more or less psychologists who then went to economics. So lots of the academics involved may have, you know, formally studied, did their PhD in psychology, but they would have also studied maths alongside it. And actually, in this day and age, most psychologists, at least if you're like me and you've got a research background, you've got to be incredibly mathematically literate, I suppose, because the amount of statistical testing that you have to do is really quite extensive. And because you've got the problems of the sort of early 2000s to sort of 2010s of the replicability crisis in the human sciences, so your sort of sociologies, your psychologies, those sorts of disciplines. And there was an interesting thing that when they tried to quantify the problem, actually the ones that were more sort of empirically based and less social, if you will, the more you get into the social side of things, the more there are research problems. But actually a lot of the cognitive psychology and things like neuroscience and that end of it, the more scientific, more modern end, if you will, fared a lot better for replicability than lots of others. And so a lot of these studies that have come out of, say, the 70s, the 60s, some even the late 50s, have actually fared quite well. And some of them have aged very well, and we'll be touching on some of them later.
So economics, of course, is, or economics has a much longer history going back to, I know, Adam Smith, classically, the, you know, the 19th century author.
But even Adam Smith, he discussed loss aversion, which is something we're going to discuss later.
Right.
So in his day, there wasn't this taboo at looking at human psychology and its impact on economics, certainly not to the degree that there was in the earlier part of the 20th century. And so he was actually happy to discuss the psychological effects. And
okay, so it started. Of course, the field of economics would have started off with more maverick thinkers like Adam Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Then it started to become more regularized and more sort of bolted down. And I mean, certainly the fact when I was doing my economics degree, I found that you had these economists who kind of had this physicist envy. Well, yeah, they wanted to turn everything into equations.
I think there's a similar thing in sort of political science, and there was at one point a similar thing in psychology of a preoccupation with weeding out some of the sort of practices that undermined our disciplines because we wanted to be recognised on par with the natural sciences. And with psychology, that certainly happened with things like neuroscience. No one says, oh, neuroscience, they're all a bunch of quacks, aren't they? You know, they don't know what they're talking about, because neuroimaging is pretty difficult to get completely wrong. You know, you have an image of the brain, you see the parts of the brain light up.
It looks scientific anyway, yes.
Yeah, and so that aspect makes sense and lends some credibility to the world of psychology. And I think that now economists have sort of benefited from embracing behavioural economics. They can say, oh, well, we've got this sort of empirically tested, we've got these empirically tested insights into human behaviour from psychology, and now we can apply these to our understanding of the economy and economics. And actually you find that they have a lot more explanatory power than the kinds of theories that you had pre-World War II.
So, I mean, but in a nutshell, economics was established by the turn of the 20th century.
Yes.
Early 20th century, the field of psychology really starts to get going.
Yes, it's quite a young science, depending on which part of psychology.
And then
some of it isn't scientific.
And then by the 60s, 70s, these two fields have started to merge.
Well, it wasn't until the 1990s, really, that you start seeing economists actually embrace behavioural economics. So they'd sort of developed in isolation for a while.
Right.
And then there was a realisation sort of that there was a sort of trickle. But it's, for example, one of the key behavioural economists only won the Nobel Prize for economics in 2002 for research he did in the 70s and 80s.
Right.
So that sort of speaks of the sort of lag between the two disciplines, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, there was always a bit of a lag with the Nobel Prize, well, the sensible Nobel Prizes, not the Peace Prizes and mm-hmm. stuff. But yeah, that is still quite a long lag.
Yeah, but it's that sort of distance between the two disciplines of behavioural economics was a little bit ahead of the game compared to economics, but now it's been embraced by economics, and now there isn't really this distinction between. It's just a nice, neat overlap between economists, and then you've sort of got behavioural economists in the middle, and then psychologists. And there's not really, there's a sort of contribution and collaboration between.
So I think I started my degree in 1999. So that would explain why, if it was only really coming into its own in the 1990s, is why it didn't feature. But presumably, if I were to do an economics degree these days, it probably would just be bundled in with it.
I would be very surprised if they skirted over it, because it fundamentally changes your view of economics, in my opinion. I actually found it complemented Austrian economics very well, which is also interesting, because that often gets sidelined as well.
Most definitely. I remember a lecturer spending an entire lecture basically just wistfully eyed describing how it was possible to go to the British Museum and sit in the very same chair that Karl Marx used to sit in. He hijacked an entire lecture just to talk about sitting in the same seat as Karl Marx. So, yeah, not a lot of Austrian economics was done, to say the least. So, classical economics, which is probably, you know, the man on the street level understanding of economics, probably your A-level type economics, is essentially the sort of the classical theories. And that's got a couple of key underpinnings.
Yes.
And, well, I mean, let's just talk about those, because it feels like behavioural economics sort of gives a shunt to all of them.
Well, yes, because they're wrong.
Right. Okay. So pick the first one of one of the key tenets of classical economics. Self-interest, for example. So actions are driven purely by self-interest.
Well, that's not entirely true, and in fact, there are experiments that are done whereby if you are cooperating, or you're even antagonistic in games of risk and reward. Where money, real world money as well, because all of these experiments, they understand that if the money is fake, people don't care. If you're playing for real money, all of a sudden it changes the nature of the experiment. But people don't always try and screw over the person that they're either competing with or competing alongside. They actually are far more collaborative and, dare I say, altruistic, although there's certainly indication in the psychological literature that altruism is just an extension of self-interest, but that's right.
The experiment I'm thinking of here is that game where basically you've got two people and you say you're going to split £100.
Yes.
And the first person gets to decide the split, so they can decide how much they're going to keep and how much the other person is going to receive. So they decide the split. The second person can accept or reject the deal in its entirety. So if they reject the deal, nobody gets any money. Now, classical economics would tell you that the first person could do the split, which is £99 for me, £1 for you. And if we're operating on classical economics, you would say, I'm up a pound, and therefore you'd always accept the deal. However, I don't think that's how the experiment actually goes down.
Well, of course, the human mind mediates potential gains and losses based on the social fairness of them. Like, you hear people talking about inequality quite a lot in politics, don't you? Even though, you know, the argument is posed to them that you're materially better off, they don't process it in that way. And they're not necessarily wrong either, that, you know, there is potentially some loss there. But you can even run that experiment and not give the other person the option to accept or reject it. And people will still choose something other than 99 to me and 1 to you as a split.
Right.
So that suggests that there's something deeper there. And to my understanding,
yes,
human beings are sociable animals. We depended on groups of human beings working together to survive. And so if we were purely self-interested, we would be exiled from the group. And
yes,
that would actually affect our ability to survive far more detrimentally than that short-term benefit. Okay. And so actually being somewhat pro-social is the most self-interested
thing you can be. Yeah, and sort of 99% of people are pro-social, mm-hmm. and the other 1% are top 10 Reddit contributors. that sort of dilemma. Right.
Well, pro-social in the sense of not necessarily that you like going outside and talking to people and you don't live in your mum's yes. basement, but more that you are going out of your way to benefit the people around you, be it in terms of resources or, you know, you're giving them the social capital that will allow them to pursue.
Or putting the trolley back after.
That too. That's yes. a good example.
Okay. Yes. The next one is another tenet of classical economics would be complete information. Mm-hmm. That basically you have access to your decision. Whenever the classical economic models are done, it's, you know, these are all the factors that can be considered, and therefore they are considered. Everything is priced in. Mm-hmm. But again, that's just not the case.
Yeah, allow me to sort of pose a scenario to you. Imagine you're I don't know, shopping for some shoes or something. It's just been Christmas, that's on my mind. And you go to a shop and you have a look at a pair of shoes that you kind of like, and you're considering buying them. Do you then look at every other pair of shoes available to you in your size individually? Or do you think, these are the kind of shoes that I like. They meet a certain criteria that I've been looking for. I don't necessarily need to look at every shoe that's ever been made to see if I'm getting the best deal, or, you know, there's one out there that I like. You don't necessarily look to maximise your utility because the resources used to expend all that effort would far outweigh the benefit of the utility maximisation.
So I'll give you an even better example of that. I was recently trying to buy a retractable dog lead on Amazon. Right. Now,
the ones, yeah.
How much time do I really want to spend on that? I mean, I need a bloody lead, dog wants a walk. Go on Amazon. So I'm prepared to spend maybe 3 or 4 minutes on this task. And then I call up the list and there's hundreds of them. Right. And there's the absolute cheapest one, which is like, I don't know, like £7 or something. And what I end up doing, and loads of people must do this, is I'm not even going to go and read the top 10. I'm just going to look at the prices. Okay, the cheapest one is £7. The most expensive one is like £60. Well, why don't I just go a little bit up from the, you know, let's look for something that's like 17 quid or something, and I'll just go there. Mm-hmm. And this, I mean, that's a really bad way of making a decision, but I kind of found myself defaulting to it anyway, because I was trying to use price as a proxy for information.
It's bad based on some criteria, sure, but at the same time, if you were to follow the model provided by classical economics, well, you would be there looking at every single dog lead, analysing the ins and outs until you knew every dog lead off by heart.
Yes.
And then you choose the one that, based on this very clearly defined criteria in your head, meets all of those criteria and therefore is the optimal decision for you. Mm. But of course, you would have expended, you know, maybe multiple days choosing this dog lead, which isn't that important to you.
I might do that for a car.
Mm-hmm. But the point being here is that classical economics assumed that in isolation, with their mathematical models, that people behaved perfectly rationally based on these, that they would go out of their way to optimise, and actually people have other concerns other than the decision. You know, the decision is only a part of their life. It's only a sort of brick building a house. It's not necessarily... Yes. The end of the world for them, and this information got lost because they were looking at it from a mathematical perspective rather than looking at the human beings behind it and how they might approach it a bit more subjectively. And I think that actually if a decision isn't that important to you, it makes sense that you don't spend all of the time in the world trying to consider it.
Another core tenet is that preferences are stable over time, and that's obviously not the case. There are fads and there are, you know, things go in and out. The whole concept of a fashion sort of knocks that one on its head.
Well, it's true of even things as basic as food, isn't it? There are fad foods that come in and out of fashion and prominence, and you can look at them. You can even see graphs of their sales over time. I bet there was a peak for asparagus at some point, because that was the in thing for a while. I don't know why there were fashionable foods that conformity extends all the way to what you eat, but it goes to show that even things that you depend on to live, food, can be influenced socially and not purely rationally.
Yeah, I once went to a Michelin-starred restaurant where asparagus was on the menu for all three courses. They even made an asparagus mousse or something.
It's cheap and easy to make, and it can be made to taste good in quite a low-effort
way. I ordered it.
So that would be... It is nice as well, but it's sort of a red flag of, oh, this restaurant's taking shortcuts for me.
Well, no, it was quite a good restaurant.
I'm sure it was if it was Michelin star.
Yes. Another one, just while I'm finishing off the whole classical stuff, is that higher prices lead to lower demand. That is a key tenet in that, you'd see. It's the whole supply and demand chart. Price goes up, demand for it goes down. But I mean, leading back to my point about the dog leagues, is a lot of the time people actually use price as a proxy. So the experiment I've heard here is, you give people wines to taste, blind testing, and you tell them the price of the wine, and you can basically give them the same wine three times and tell them it's three different prices, and they will consistently say that the expensive one is the one they like the most, even though it's the same wine.
I've actually had this explained to me by a sommelier when I was being trained to do wine testing at a restaurant that I worked at.
You're a sommelier as well? we must do a Brokenomics on that.
I'm more than happy to talk about wine, even more happy to try tasting them if you want.
Your skill set knows no bounds, sir.
Well, I did the cocktail episode, didn't
yes,
I?
Yes, yes. Yes, check that out.
Mm-hmm. But there's a very interesting thing of where... If you actually have knowledge of the wines, like the actual wine tasters, the people who do it for a profession, they're much better at ranking which wine goes where than your average person. You know, you can make someone who's had, some reasonably okay quality wine, all of a sudden think it's fantastic wine because they're told that it's really expensive, or vice versa. You know, obviously there's still some degree of objectivity if it's sort of... Tesco's own brand, bottom shelf red.
Yeah.
Your taste buds aren't going to lie to you to that extent that you're going to think it's £150 worth. But that provides a good sort of model for how humans' judgment can be shaped, because of course the experts are much better at being able to price something and to know its value than your average consumer. However, through expertise, you can rank things in a sort of reasonable way. But you are right, and that is the exact turn of phrase, that people do use price as a proxy for value, when actually value is in their own head. You know, value is subjective. Yes. And so they're actually externalizing the value of something because they're assuming that price is actually a valid marker of the value of the product.
I've got another example. So when I was in VC, one of the businesses I invested in, I better not say the name, but it was a small chocolate company. And they basically had two customers. It was Harrods and those really cheap, I don't think they exist anymore, but those really cheap corner shops. It wasn't Spa, it was something like that. But
Londis?
Along
those lines.
Older and worse than that. But it was the cheapest it was the cheapest Charlie corner shop going at the time, right? So Harrods and the really cheap shop, and they produced exactly the same chocolate, and they sold it for like 50p a bag in the corner shops and for £10 a bag in Harrods. Exactly the same chocolate.
It doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time, actually, the way I sort of account for the knowledge of this phenomenon going on in my own purchasing decisions is that I either, if I'm using Amazon, for example, I'll sort by reviews and then at least have some sort of benchmark of what do people who have used these products have to say. And I also read the sort of specifications I use. I'm quite fussy about things. I'll even look at the weight of different products to assess their quality because, heavier can be a benchmark for more expensive. But then I'm also someone who's researched decision-making and deliberately going out of my way to overcome the biases that exist, which I'm sure we'll get onto in a bit.
Okay. And the other one, just to close off this, is that future rewards are consistently discounted, so that there's this nice smooth valuation metric into the future. Now, this one particularly resonated with me because obviously there are economists like us who are, you know, well, you're also a behavioural economist, but Austrian economists.
Mm-hmm.
We don't get employed by central banks and governments. Keynesian economists get employed by central banks. And they seem to gravitate to this. And every economic model I've ever seen produced by a central bank or government is basically a straight line up. It takes no account of the business cycle.
Well, they deliberately engineer them that way because they look good.
Mm.
That's the thing. That if a graph has a perfectly straight line, and particularly if it's a nice sort of angle where it's sort of perpendicular to the axes, it kind of raises red flags in my mind, at least as a sort of statistician, is that there's been some sort of behind-the-scenes jiggery-pokery, that's the technical term, I'm sure, basically they change the numbers behind the scenes to create the graph in a way in which looks aesthetically pleasing. It makes them look like they're a real economist, rather than actually sometimes graphs might not necessarily show a noticeable trend. And in fact, if you look at things like experimental psychology, where you're measuring very, very small effects that may or may not even exist, you get all sorts of weird and unusual shapes out of your graph. And so to see a very clear and straight line when you're talking about human behaviour, because of course there's a large amount of variance in human behaviour, not all humans behave in the same way. And many of the things we're talking about today are general trends that not everyone
Yeah,
might
it's like
follow.
That marshmallow test with children, isn't it? Where you say to the kid, you know, I think you do this experiment aged about 2 or 3 or something. You can have a marshmallow right now, or tomorrow you can have a whole bag of marshmallows or something like that. And you know, the ones who put off the decision are the ones who are going to do well. So, yeah, it's not uniform, but broadly people tend to overweight right here, right now.
That's true. Yeah, that's one of the insights from behavioural economics is that actually people don't rationally approach time preference, if you will.
Yes.
And that they disproportionately favour the immediate over the long term. And I think that this is a largely sort of hunter-gatherer relic, if you will.
Okay.
There have been lots of evolutionary explanations of this to say that, you know, if you're living hand to mouth, you know, out surviving, then immediate food is worth a lot more to you than food that you could potentially gather and save for later that might spoil, that you might lose in transit.
Have taken from you. Yeah.
There are lots of things that can happen. And in fact, if you're carrying lots of food around with you in an area where there are predators, well, that's trouble. You know, anyone who goes camping in bear country will know that you don't keep the food near you when there are predators nearby, because you could end up being their lunch rather than the food that you've got.
Yes.
And so there are very tangible reasons why there are these biases. They're not they're not necessarily what you could regard as flaws in human beings, because they served a purpose and we're here today because of them. But it's just that the selection pressures on human beings have changed, and so what once allowed us to survive in the wilderness.
Yeah, so slightly spicy take, but I think that there is a genuine difference between those cultures whose last couple of 100,000 years or 1 million years of evolution has included winter and those who haven't.
Well, The difference in GDP in the Northern Hemisphere is very different than that of the Southern Hemisphere, which tends to have less distinct seasons.
Yes, because in one of those environments, you are selected out if you don't go for the immediate gratification thing, because of all the reasons you said, it can be taken from you, it can spoil, it can all that kind of thing. And then the other one, you are selected out if you don't have that long time preference and you put enough aside to get you through the winter.
Well, there's a lot of paleoanthropological evidence to suggest that there's truth to what you're saying, in that there were lots and lots of, even before anatomically modern human beings existed some 300,000 years ago, our sort of cousins and even, you know, some of our ancestors, when they were sort of Homo erectus, they weren't even distinctly Homo sapiens by this point, tried to colonize parts of Europe and Asia and failed because it was a harsh landscape. It wasn't a temperature in which they were adapted to. And it was only in, only much later, really, that you had anatomically modern humans settling these areas, in great numbers at least. There were sort of, you've got things like Homo heidelbergensis found in the Heidelberg forests in, I think that's Germany. Sounds like it.
Sounds German, doesn't it? Yes.
But they were there long before anatomically modern humans existed, but in much fewer numbers and eventually died out.
And when those populations moved, they would have immediately experienced the whole. So again, going back to, you know, the individuals are different within the group. When the first lot of Habo hybridlicenses, whatever they were,
close enough.
Yes. When they started moving up, you know, there would have been some of them that favoured putting food aside. There'd be some that favoured immediate consumption, and you would have that immediate selection pressure. So only the ones who could plan for winter and a high GDP in a million years' time would have survived.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.